Well, thanks for being here today. I'm so happy to see you all. It's good to be together. I really take what Tate had to say very, very personally and very, very seriously. Jeff Shadowin is one of the great guys I think I've ever known when it comes to trusting in the Lord with all his heart and leaning not to his own understanding. Because if he just would lean on his own understanding, they would have left Basque Country a long time ago. But he continues to pour his life into the Basque people and into the new missionaries that are there. And somehow I know that God is going to honor this. I hear Tate say that their sweet little girl, who really is an adorable young person, expressed this, but I can't go there, but I can't receive that, but I don't want to know, but this pushback. And I'll tell you, that doesn't break my heart, because I think about Amy Carmichael, fabulous missionary, primarily to India, and how she changed a whole province and region in India, and it's still changed, and the kind of opposition that this one woman encountered when she got there. But she says at one point, and I've told you this before, I want you to think about it. If you're sitting in an absolutely dark room, and the Bass people are sitting in an absolutely dark room. If you're sitting in an absolutely dark room and you just crack open the door, the room fills with light. I think that being at camp this week gives these young people an opportunity to have the door crack open. They're going to be presented with things they've never imagined. Now, that's a little bit hard for us, because most of us were raised Christianly. They weren't. Jeff just completed, well, I shouldn't say completed, he just finished his first go-round on an essay, or a long essay, about the resistance in the Basque Country. I remember when John took those FCA college students over there, and I was all excited that they were going. And when they came back, the one thing that seemed to be, like I like to say, unanimous amongst them all, was that it was dark, that they sensed darkness, that whether it would be the bus driver or the waitress or whatever, that when they traveled around with Jeff and Mary, it was as if there was light into darkness, and they could sense that. And if you know John, you know that he's somebody that doesn't like to go places that you can't really defend. But he went there with that because that was their experience. And I would say that to a great degree, that was our experience too. I think that our group, both times, had so much light within, and the Davenports and other people are so sold out to Jesus that we fed off of their light so much, and that's so beautiful. But there are things going on that are in the heavenlies that we just will not understand. We're going to get to that in a minute. Second thing I want to talk about is this week, my family and I spent some time in the garden. If you haven't, please do. Please just go out there and say, wow, I've never seen such flowers, because it's ridiculously fabulous. Or pick some corn, pick some golden squash, pick whatever else. I think there's some broccoli and things like that. There's a lot out there. But here's the thing. I think that it would be a measurable change in the effect that the church has on our culture if most churches had a garden like we have. And I'll tell you why. It isn't because we can't afford our food or anything like that. It is the experience of being in a place that is a mirror to what God put man in to start with. A place of ornate natural beauty. And I want to commend Austin and Christy and Bruce and whoever else has been out there and keeping it so beautiful. It's beautiful. Right now, it's just fabulous. And I think in a couple weeks, this is something I love. I hear this all the time on TV or the radio. People saying things literally. Well, they literally this, they literally that. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you know what it mean? You know what literally means? Well, I'm going to use one. We're literally going to have tomatoes coming out of our ears. Okay? They would say that, and I think, wait a minute. That would be strange. That would be a new story. But we're going to have so many wonderful tomatoes and stuff. And all of that because God meets us there if we want him to. If we want God to meet us there, he does. And there's something else that I think leads into today's message somewhat. A few years ago, Bill's mom died, and I went to the funeral. And Bill's mom and dad are buried in a place that I wish we had. I wish every church had. Some churches of that era have these, but most churches don't. And that is a churchyard with a cemetery in it. Now, I've said this, I did a whole sermon on this 8 years ago, whatever. And we're never going to have this. But if we had a cemetery out there somewhere in the beauty, every time we came here, we would be reminded of the promise that those graves are going to be opened. And that those people who were faithful here, who were laid to rest here, are being so close to the church. And it's powerful. I love churchyards. If you go to New England, you'll see some great old churchyards. And you'll read epitaphs that are epitaphs of faithful people. And you'll think, you know what? This person may have died in 1712. But what I just read about this person is more alive than they've ever been. And they're alive forever. And it's a beautiful thing. I think of our topic today, and I guess my first thing I want to say is it's not possible to hold this idea of sin and what sin has meant in our world, to hold on to that idea and fully weigh it. No one has ever done that because we are so bathed in sin. But we're going to get to, hopefully, today, and I think in future weeks, some understandings that will help us. I'd like you to take out your program if you have one. And if you don't, turn to Ephesians 6, 11 and 12. So what good is this study of Genesis 1:11? I want to thank Dave, who's not here, but Dave, last week, did exactly what I was hoping he would do. We met them for dinner, Dave and Lauren, and I said, I'd already talked to him on the phone, but I said, Dave, here's how I'd kind of like you to approach this topic. And he did it to the max. It was so good. Some of you said afterwards that why haven't we considered him for a pastor? And I said, you know, if the topic every week was classical music, he'd be a good one. But it isn't. But what a great couple, and I want to thank him. It was a reminder of the beauty, the brilliance, and I think the fabulous song that are these two stories, songs, that are these two stories of creation. Okay, why study Genesis 1 through 11? Because as I said at the beginning, we live in a world that has no regard for Genesis 1 through 11. And if we don't know it, if we don't understand it, if we don't dive in and mine the gems that are in Genesis 1 through 11, we will not understand our lives. We will not understand life and death and the struggle of living. We just won't get it. I think this passage from Ephesians should help position us as we consider what we're going to read today. All right? Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against what? Against the schemes of the devil. Now, is Paul just speaking metaphorically here, or is he really just saying, be a religious person because bad things are going to happen? No, he is not. He's saying we have an enemy of our souls, and that enemy of our souls is very influential, and he schemes, and we'll see that scheme in Genesis 3. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this phrase. This is the phrase. This is the phrase. This present darkness. There was a teacher at Carlock Grade School when, I don't know, Becky, if you ever had Mrs. Caldwell. Did you ever have her? Yeah. And I know John had her for some things because I got involved a little bit. But she's a farm wife, lives out by down somewhere, and she's a really neat lady. Mrs. Caldwell. Does anybody know Mrs. Caldwell? You do. Yay. Bridget? Is that her name? Yeah, Bridget Caldwell. She's a gem. Clint, you know her? She's a gem. Tell her I spoke of her if you see her. And then duck. No, don't. She was reading what I had just read at the time. This is a long time ago. I had just read This Present Darkness. Now, raise your hand if you've read This Present Darkness. Yay, good. It's in the library. This Present Darkness is a novel about the spiritual struggle in these people's lives. It's very dualistic. Maybe, and what I mean by that is black, white, good, bad, da, da. And in that way, I think it's a little bit weak, but I still liked it. She really liked it. So then a couple years later, I absolutely read this. This Present Darkness was being made into a movie. And so I saw Bridget and I said, hey, guess what? This Present Darkness is being made into a movie. She was beside herself. That is great. Oh, there's so many people I want to take. Oh, thank you. It was like I was making a movie or something, which, you know. They've never made it into a movie. And whenever she sees me, and I see her every now and then, she'll say, where's that movie? And I will say, they're still working on it. This present darkness is just the reality of the mud and the mire that is life on this planet. Over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Let's have that passage, which I think we can all say that's important in 2017 to each of us. It's important in 2017 to understand that we have an opponent, that opponent schemes, that opponent understands some things. And that's who we wrestle against. We can get mad at somebody or some movement or whatever, but really, the scheming is being led by our enemy, an ancient enemy, once the most beautiful creation of God, Lucifer. I imagine this. I imagine ancient Israel in Egypt serving as slaves. Now, appreciate something. There is no Bible. Appreciate something else. At this time, there is no priesthood. Appreciate something else. There are all kinds of thoughts that are borrowed thoughts or created thoughts about God, gods, idols, powers, superstitions. There are all kinds of those thoughts in this, some people believe, and I'm with them, 4 million people. Because none of the structures that we understand that are in place for the children of Israel are yet in place. But they are a people group. They are a people group. And God has set them apart for his purposes. This is what I imagine. I imagine a little boy or a little girl. I'm going to say 8 to 10 years old. Comes to her or his mother in tears and says, "Mommy, why are they doing this to Daddy? Why are they beating Daddy? Why is Daddy a terrible slave to these Egyptians? Why do they treat us so poorly?" And I imagine Moses is aware of that. I'm certain that he is. Now, Moses didn't write the books of Moses in response to some little kid. But in writing these books, he had the questions, the emptiness, the brokenness of his own people's experience right in front of his eyes all the time. And if we think about the things that he says throughout these books, we know that this message to his people is so directly intended to help them understand why things are the way they are. Now, here's an amazing thing about Scripture. These books of Moses, they still speak to us, don't they? They speak to us with power. They speak to us with explanation of the way things really are. So we've had, up until now in this series, we've really had a good time because everything we've studied has been a good thing. We've had these two different creation accounts, but they're not warring with each other, that they blend. And we've talked about them, and I hope we're encouraged by something, and it's this. No one absolutely knows the intent of the author here. No one absolutely is able to say it was 7 24-hour days, or it was 7 periods of time, or it was 7 structures in the development of things. No one can say for certain, but this is what I want to say. The closer I think we can come to taking this as literally as we can take it, the stronger our position, the stronger our understanding. And it's interesting to me because I've been all over the board in my life with this. I certainly, when I became a Christian, didn't know enough about it to make any assessment. But then my whole life studying these things, I probably swung a little bit more to the way of, oh, it's just metaphorical. And then I went to this fabulous grad school where seriously, I was one of the dumbest people there. There's no question about it. That was a bunch of smart people. And I just was like this, and they were like, grr. So that's how it was. And these people who were brilliant with all kinds of degrees and doctors and language and this and that and the other, they actually believed this. I remember asking Dr. Bullock, do you believe this Genesis 1 account? He said, absolutely. And so then I saw, you know, my pushback on this has a lot to do with not wanting to be embarrassed in the world. Has a lot to do with not wanting to say to someone, hey, by the way, I believe this. Because these really good minds taught me that one of the safest places to be is on the side of just receive it, just accept it, just let it form a basis and a foundation. Because you know what? No one really knows. So you got to settle somewhere. I imagine that child, I imagine Moses writing a long and glorious account of God's creation and of his people. And I imagine chapter 3 being the turning point, being a point where when in future years a little kid would say, hey, mommy, why was grandpa killed and he was so young? Or why did those people steal from us? Or where is daddy? I can imagine then that this chapter 3 would be talked about, would be shared, would be taught. So let's turn to Genesis 3. You'll see every week I'm putting some Hebrew in the program, and that's very intentional to make us understand that this was originally written in Hebrew and that the Hebrew language, fabulously expressive, as is Greek. And in today's reading, in chapter 3, verse 1, which is what you have up there in Hebrew, we have a very important distinction made. So here we go. Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. So now when I just read that the way it is there, I'm thinking of the serpent just going, hee, 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 crafty. I'm going to fool them kind of thing. Let me tell you something. I don't think that's it at all. And you'll see in other translations, and I love the ESV, it's what we use, I love it, and I think it's good, but I also know this, that I've heard this spoken of very strongly by more than one Hebrew scholar who says it is not possible. It's just like that word has said that we study every week at prayer. It's just not possible for us to understand in English exactly what this means. This term, more crafty, according to a lot of scholars, is exquisitely and paralyzingly beautiful. You'll see in a lot of translations the word subtle. Subtle is an interesting, expandable word. I just want us to look at this and understand that when the serpent is being described here, it's not describing a snake. The snake becomes a snake later in the chapter. Okay? The serpent was more exquisite than any other animal the Lord had made. Now, this, we Christians would apply to Lucifer being thrown to the earth and expressing himself in this manner here. That's who we say it is. Now, who is this Lucifer? Well, where does Lusa, where do we see the part of the word, the root, is what I'm looking for, Lusa, where do we see that in our language? L-U-C-I. Lucid. It's clear. It's bright. And Lucifer is said to be this most amazing of all God's creations. And so what Moses is doing here, because he's encountered this dude. He's encountered this Lucifer. And what he's doing is he's telling us this force in the world can disguise himself, as Paul tells us, as an angel of light. He can disguise himself as an angel of light. And so when we look at this, and it's interesting and understandable that much of the fabulous artwork that's been created about the fall, and it really is, Janet taught art history, I can't imagine how many pieces of great art deal with Adam and Eve and the fall in the garden and all that stuff. And the serpent is a snake. Serpent's there. Serpent's wound. Serpent's this. Serpent's that. Well, that's later in the story. But at this point, we have here lucid, clear, not fouled up in appearance. Okay? Here we go. He said to the woman, "Did God actually say, 'You shall not eat of any tree in the garden?'" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" Wow. This is so packed with potential that all I can do is turn us over to Genesis 11. Can you just turn to Genesis 11? And we're going to get there. Look at 11 verse 6. This is the discussion about the Tower of Babel. "And the Lord said, 'Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them.'" Have you ever studied that before? That God is saying, we have to intervene here because mankind united in a cohort with the enemy can do some very crazy and destructive things. Now, history has shown us that that's true. But this idea here that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, it means more than I can say, and we're going to talk about it in future weeks. This tree, to eat of its fruit, is to say to God, trusting you with ultimate knowledge is not enough. I want that ultimate knowledge. Trusting you with my future is not enough. I want to trust myself for my future. It's to say, God, your prohibition to me can be ignored because I have amazing potential. That's what it says. And so in this whole thing, we have the schemer, and his scheme appeals to what? It appeals to the pride of the created ones. And anything that ever appeals to our selfish pride, we should cast aside. That is the story of history. Let's continue, though. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. Look up at the last verse of chapter 2. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. They have been naked and not ashamed, and being naked just made perfect sense because there was nothing to be ashamed of. It was to be gloried in. But now suddenly they have stepped out of line, and this whole who I am naked before another becomes a point of embarrassment, a point of shame. There's a lot to that, too. There's a lot to that, too. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. Now, we're going to be here for several weeks in this 3 and 4 of Genesis. But I want to walk through some slides with you because I want us to understand how practical this is. This seems like we're studying something that's really distant, and of course it is ancient, but how practical is it? How much does it mean? So here we go. We need to ask this question: how severe is sin? And I can think of no better way than to be at a cemetery or a funeral or a visitation of someone who would not bow the knee to Christ and someone who would just, nope, I'm not going there, and to understand that their life is over and that all hope is gone. How severe is sin? Sin is death. And when God said, if you disobey me here, it's going to cost you life. That's exactly what he meant. And we can see that. Sin cut the cord, snuffed the light, and separated the lovers. You see the painting on the cover of the program. That's what I see there. I see this tree that they've encountered, and then look at them. They're separated. It did that. It separated us from each other. It separated us from God. It separated us from ourselves. It separates us from ourselves. Do you ever not really understand yourself? Have you ever had those periods of time when you can say, psychologically, I was not healthy? I can say that. Because sin does this work in us that doesn't bring us together or closer, it separates us. Now, here's some examples that I just thought might bring this home a little bit. Because, yeah, we can say that sin is the Ten Commandments, it's murder, it's thievery, it's all these things, but you know, it's more than that. Sin is that superiority you feel, even delight in, over another person. That is sin. If I look at another person and think, I am superior to you, that is sin. Is that a common thing in life? You betcha. Is it good? Not a bit. That gossip you pretend not to enjoy, or that show full of blatant moral evil you dismiss as an acceptable diversion? Hey, you know, there are a lot of us who live our lives as Christians and try to have this sterling reputation because that's good and important, but we have these little secrets. The secret is what we do on the computer or what we do on the television or in the book or whatever. I mean, I see so many people reading these books, and the people are Christians. I'm thinking, why are you reading that book? It is full of not just 50 shades of gray, it's 50 shades of something I can't say. Why are you doing that? That anger you harbor against someone else, maybe even a relative, an anger that slowly burns but never burns out. There's nothing sadder to me than family brokenness. It shatters me. And I think it shatters you as well. When there's someone in the family that needs the love and attention of the family, but somebody's mad about something that happened in the 50s, and they're not going there because they'd have to swallow their pride. Friends, that is sin. That is failure. That is destructive. But this one, that I earned it, I own it mentality towards money and things that reveals selfishness and a lack of trust. You know, Jesus talked so much. In fact, all of these things, and we're going to get there, take us to Jesus. And we see in these things that Jesus is saying, your life is about your heart. Your life is about how free are you to live in my provision, not in anything that you would hoard for yourself, but in my provision. We were at Cal's T-ball, I don't know if you'd call it a game or event, the T-ball event the other night. Bob was there, and I was talking to a friend, and we got talking about this understanding that, well, he asked me the question, what do you tell your people they need to give to be faithful to God? And I said, I have never said there is a certain amount that they should give. But this is what I have said, probably not enough. I have said, you should give enough that it causes you to, with blessed appreciation, trust God. Not protect yourself, but to trust God. And I think that's where we need to be in all this. And so he said to me, well, he said, I just read that evangelicals give 2% of their income. And that floored me and made me mad. Because I don't give percents, but friends, it's rare if 2% is enough. That really is rare. We should give back to God with an understanding that we cannot outgive him. I've taught you before about R.G. Letourneau, the founder of one of the greatest companies in the history of the world, a very important man. As a young man, he and his wife determined, we're going to be reverse tithers. They kept 10%. They gave 90%. They became ridiculously wealthy. And they kept giving 90% and kept giving. It's awesome. Their story is awesome. Try giving more than God would just say in the 10% of the Old Testament. Okay, this is a really big one. There is, in a lot of us, we've put our foot down and we've said, I'm going to do what I can to be a good Christian, but the one thing I can't do is to forgive that person. I'm going to hold it against them. They hurt me, I'm going to hurt them. That, my friends, is sin. Now, how serious is sin? How severe is sin? Sin is death. So when we say, I'm going to hold on to this bitterness, I'm going to hold on to this bitterness, and I'm going to apply it to this person, we have just signed our own death certificate. And we're not hurting them near as much as we're hurting ourselves. So sad. Oops, what did Jesus say about these things? And we'll just run through these real quick. What do you say about lust? You remember Jimmy Carter being interviewed by Playboy when he was running for president? And the press made a huge deal of this? But he was just being honest. He said, yeah, I got to tell you, I've lusted after a lot of women. Oh, boy. Hello? Jesus says, that is adulterous. And Jimmy was just admitting what the rest of us find it hard to admit. I appreciate that. What about hatred? What did Jesus say? If lust is adultery, what is hatred? It's murder. This is such an interesting move from the law written down to the heart examined. If I hate somebody, I have murdered them. Oh, man. You know, Jesus, he upset people so much they killed him. He wasn't this guy who was just making everybody happy. He was making a lot of people mad because of what he said about things. Greed and coveting. Let's think of what he says about the widow's mite. We got a rich person. We got a widow. She's got a tiny bit, but what she has, she puts in the plate. That woman has given more than the other person. Literally? No. In reality? In heaven's economy? You betcha. Condescension. Think of his story about the Good Samaritan. Think of his meeting with the woman at Jacob's well. She says, what are you doing talking to me? And he talked to her, didn't he? And he embraced her, and he changed her life. Condescension is such an unspoken reality in, I think, the American church. I'm going to be preaching about some things that I've been studying about how God has designed the church to be so fitting for the cultures it's in. Do not think for a second that the way we do church is the only way that God says you should do church. But we do church in a way that, for me, is important because it has to be real. It has to be real. And that happens all over the world, but it doesn't look like this. And then, of course, the ultimate is humility versus pride. Jesus says, hey, you want to know me, you want to please me, you want to be healthy in your soul? Then understand that you were made from dust. Humus, the soil, humus, the same root as humility. That's who we are. We're made of dust, and the dust will go. When we do the Ash Wednesday service, which is funny for a little church like us, but it's good, because we're reminded, this is who we are. This is where we're going. Thank you, Jesus. I think most of us could probably recite John 3:16. Am I right about that? John 3:16? Boom. If I hit you and said, John 3:16, you'd hit me back and say, be quiet. But how about John 3:17? This is important now, since I've beat us all up. Let's look at this and understand what the gospel is. For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world. So I've just gone through a whole litany of sin that we can identify with and say, in some of these ways, I need help. I need cleansing. I need forgiveness. I need hope. I need energy. I need power. God did not send his son into the world to say, Kyle, it's over for you. Stop playing the drums. We've got Trey now. We don't need you. Okay. But in order that the world might be saved through him, the wrath of God. We don't talk about that very much enough. Do you think about it? Do you know what it looks like? I mean, that's a whole, let's take a week and just talk about it. But the wrath of God is necessary. The wrath of God, get ready, is the love of God. God cannot let the rebellion in the garden or the rebellion at the Tower of Babel go unchecked. But how does he check it? This is what's so fabulous. He checks it himself. He checks it by becoming one of us. Do you have any thought as to how Jesus has changed the world? The whole world. Jesus, this itinerant preacher from Nazareth, has changed the world. How? Because he did what only God could do. He took all the garbage that we have created and held on to and lived through, and he eliminated it. He took all, I'll put it in religious language, he took all of our sin. All of those list of things, all of those attitudes and bad books, and all, he took all of that, and he said, as God, I can deal with this. You cannot. I'm dealing with it on your behalf. Now when I hear that, a light starts to come into my soul. Some hope starts to come into my soul, because if I just think of what I do and what I think and who I am, it's pretty dark. But if I think of who Jesus is forever, and that Jesus tells me, in all of your misery, Dave, I love you. And in all of your desire to be important or to be loved or whatever, I am developing a new you, a new person, a new world, a new reality. Because this old one, it's got to be done away with. That's what he's doing. It's remarkable. It's his love. It's the love of God. Now, we're going to pick up with this next week. I expected to get through more, but we didn't. So let's sing and rejoice and have a good week. And thank you.